Good morning. My name is Tana Hartman, and welcome to The Wilf Show, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Our engineers today are Lucy Lewis and Dick Paddock, and our guest is Sarah Shields. She's a professor at UNC, a professor of history. And Sarah, you've been welcome. You've been at UNC since 1993, and tell us a little bit about your field, Middle Eastern history, and how you got interested.
I am a Middle East historian. I work on particularly the 19th and 20th centuries. I got interested in Middle East history as an undergraduate. I'd grown up in a house that talked often about issues of the Middle East. I grew up in a household where my parents very strongly supported Israel. And that was really the most important thing in my household and my life as a young child. So I started pursuing Middle East history as an undergraduate, and was really sort of surprised by the difference in the things that I learned from the things that I'd known. And so I switched. I got into European history for my master's degree. And then I was just drawn back to it. So for my PhD, I focused on the Ottoman Empire.
I want to talk a little bit about, for far too many of us, Islam is this monolithic, you know, religion, but it is much richer, has a tremendous history, and a much greater diversity than most Americans ever realize. Tell us a little bit about Islam and its history, a little bit about that rich diversity.
Well, I was really impressed with the rich diversity. I was fortunate to have a grant to study and do research, and went to the Middle East last summer. We started off with funding from a number of university, UNC institutions, spent a month in Morocco, traveling around Morocco, which has an incredibly rich history, and beautiful, it's a beautiful place, the people are wonderful, and I was really struck by Moroccan Islam, because Morocco seemed very, very different than Turkey, which was the other place I've spent most of my time. And after a month in Morocco, we spent 5 months in northern Syria, which is a very secular state with some very, very religious people in it. And when we left Morocco, when we left Syria, we spent 2 weeks in Mali, which is in West Africa. The capital is Bamako, and it's an 82% Muslim majority country. And in the space of a summer and a semester, I'd been to a number of different countries that had majority Muslim populations, and they were remarkably different. The governments were different in each one, and the way women dressed was different in each one, and the way people prayed was different in each one, and what people ate and drank was different in each one. And I was really struck by how we talk about Islam as though it's some monolith, whereas actually it's so varied.
Well, a little bit. I've read that there are 1.3 billion Muslims in the globe. Fewer than 20% of those are Arabs, and most of the population is outside of what we consider the Arab region of the world, and the largest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia.
The largest Muslim, the country with the largest Muslim population is Indonesia, and most Muslims don't live in the Middle East, and most Muslims are not Arabic speakers. They pray in Arabic, though. We got into a car in Bamako, and our driver was Bambara, and he was listening to a cassette tape that I was really struck by, because I couldn't understand anything, and then intermittently there was some Arabic, and I asked him what he was listening to, and it turns out that the chief imam, the chief religious leader of Mali, is a very popular preacher, and he distributes cassettes. Cassettes of his sermons are distributed, and they're in Bambara with Quranic quotes in Arabic, and that's what's listened to by devout Muslims in Mali, West Africa.
If you listen to mainstream media very often, it comes off, especially since 2001, as if Islam, it almost directly equates with terrorism, and that democracy and Islam are essentially inimical to one another. But that's not true, I'm learning, as I've been reading.
Well, I'm a historian. I don't do religious studies. So whether Islam is inherently consistent with or contradictory to democracy is something that I think somebody who studies Islamic law would have to talk about. Yeah. I'm a historian, so I can talk about the extent to which people who want to have democratic rule cite Islam as one of the reasons that they want democratic rule. I just did a lecture for my students in my modern Middle East class about what happens after the Iranian Revolution. And the most striking thing to me about it was the conflict, and actually the conflict continues, between groups in Iran that want an Islamic Republic, which is democratic explicitly, and they try to put together Islam and democracy and argue that the two are completely consistent and compatible. And people among the elites in Iran that want to have an autocratic government run from the top down and not democratic. And they also talk about the extent to which Islam needs to be primary, that it's not an Islamic government has to come first, and that doesn't have to be democratic. So within Iran itself, you know, they're all Shiites, or overwhelmingly Shiites, and even the elite clerics in Iran argue about democracy and the extent of collective democratic rule and the extent of top-down rule. But I was particularly struck this morning when I was reading an article going through the history of the recent occupation of Iraq, to read about how the Bush administration, that talks so much about democratizing the Middle East and didn't want to have democratic elections in Iraq when they first invaded. Yeah. And it was the Ayatollah Sistani, Iraq's chief cleric, who demanded one person, one vote elections. And when the Bush administration refused, 40,000 Iraqis took to the streets to demand popular vote. And remember those first elections with the purple finger of freedom?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Those were called because Ayatollah Sistani, the chief Shiite official in Iraq, insisted that Iraq become a democratic state.
That's very interesting. I think I remember now that they didn't want, that our government didn't want.
They wanted something that they were calling caucuses. That sounded kind of like Iowa.
Okay. I'm not sure what that means. Tell us a little bit about, by the way, I wanted to mention, you have a really great blog that you have kept during your travels and kept up. And I found myself getting on it and getting really engrossed and staying there and reading and reading and reading. It's well written and it's very interesting.
You.
Tell people the how they would find that blog.
When we left Chapel Hill in June of last year, our end destination was to be Timbuktu. So we called the blog From Chapel Hill to Timbuktu. It's at sshields.wordpress.com. I blogged the whole time we were in the Middle East and North Africa, and in through Mali. While we were in Syria for those 5 months, we also visited Petra, and we were in Turkey briefly. We were in Lebanon, and everywhere we went, I wrote, and William took photographs, and many of the photographs I also posted. He took 6,000. I think I posted a few dozen. I'm about to take, like next week, I'm about to take some UNC students on a Birchfield seminar to Turkey, and I'm trying to figure out how to blog in Turkey because WordPress is blocked in Turkey.
Why is that?
There was a political issue. And WordPress was sued and was told that they had to not, they've been blocked in Turkey. And Blogspot is blocked in Syria. And we plan to be in both places this summer. And I'm not sure how to blog. I may have to have two different blogs and link them to each other. I'm also going to encourage my students, my Carolina students, to blog. So if people are interested, they should either send me an email or comment on my blog. And I'll try to send out URLs to my blog and student blogs.
Great. What do you see as the primary issues right now with that are affecting, affecting, I want to say, the perceptions of Muslims and of the Middle East in this country?
I think that that Americans have little enough information that's accurate about Muslims, that we tend to be willing to believe what we're told. Mm. And I think that has to do with a lack of accurate information. I was struck reading the New York Times report about the way analysts for the our message multipliers, television analysts have become message multipliers for the Pentagon. And I think that they crowd out anyone who could actually inform Americans about the Middle East. I know most of my colleagues in Middle Eastern history, politics, Islamic religion, weren't asked to be television commentators in the run-up to the Iraq War. And they're not being asked to be commentators now. So what we've seen in the last 2 weeks, which is very frightening to people in my field, is an apparent effort to vilify Iran and encourage Americans to believe that Iran is behind all of America's troubles in the Middle East in an effort to make it acceptable to Americans to go to war. So I was really struck when I was asked a couple of days ago, so why study history and what's the point of history? And one of the points of history is that then you know which things are likely to be inaccurate. I heard on the radio 2 days ago that the Iranian regime is supplying weapons to the Taliban. I mean, any historian knows, or any scholar of the region knows, that this is absolutely fabricated. There is no way that, considering the history of these two groups that have been at loggerheads since their creation, the Iranians actually worked with the United States during the early part of the United States invasion of Afghanistan to help topple the Taliban. The Taliban, as any reader of the popular novel Kite Runner knows, has devastated Afghanistan's internal Hazara Shiite population. These two groups have been at odds since the Taliban came on the scene. And the Iranians helped the United States in our attack of Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban. Nonetheless, because Americans seem to have little information and short memories, people don't say, but wait a minute, of course Iran isn't supplying the Taliban. Instead, we're willing to say that a Muslim is a Muslim is a Muslim, and therefore all Muslims would be fighting together because they hate us.
Right.
And therefore, of course, Iran would be supplying weapons to everyone, everywhere, that would hate the United States, and so we have to attack Iran. And the narrative works as it's presented, but it's inaccurate. We were really struck while we were in Syria, while we were in Mali, while we were in Turkey, while we were in Jordan, with everyone coming up to us, not everyone, many people, taxi drivers, people on the street, grocers, saying, why does America hate us? And I felt like I'd spent months answering that question after September 11th. Why do Muslims hate us?
What did you say?
Well, I said, Americans don't hate you. Americans don't have much information. Americans think that all Muslims are the same, that the people who support the Taliban are the same people who live in Jordan, the people who are supporting the extremists of the Iranian government are the same people who live in Syria. And that's simply inaccurate. There's tremendous diversity among Muslims. There are secular Muslims, there are religious Muslims, there are people that we would call extremist and violent Muslims. But it would be as if everyone in Syria, for example, thought that all Christians were like Timothy McVeigh or like Gerald Falwell or like any of the people who blow up Christians that they don't agree with. Tend to see these spectacular, horrific acts as being carried out by people who represent Islam. Whereas when people who are Christians carry out horrific acts, we assume that they represent no one but themselves.
I was thinking about this recently, and there is. I mean, we don't assume that Christianity and all Christians are alike, you know.
But we do assume Muslims are all alike.
Yeah, that all Muslims are alike. I want to take just a moment here to make a little announcement about tomorrow, the Really, Really Free Market. It's a monthly community event, and you can go and share goods, skills, services, and ideas all for free. It is absolutely free. Everyone's invited. Bring useful or beautiful things to give away. Bring supplies to create something during the event. Bring skills to teach or just wisdom to share. The event's self-organized by everyone who participates. Each participant is responsible for items brought that are not taken away. And it happens on the first Saturday of each month. It's from 2:30 to 5:30 at the Carborough Town Commons. It's free and open to the public. Please get out and join it. Now, I want to get back a little more. We're talking with Professor Sarah Shields from UNC. She is a historian of the Middle East and has, you have quite an impressively long list of publications and presentations and talks, and that. And tell me a little bit about your what would you, if there is there anyone, anything that you could tell us that would help people to understand Islam or Muslims, right? More, is there some place we can go? What can we do to sort of losing the word to make up for what we're not getting, you know, through our media, and to educate ourselves? How can we do that?
I think a really good place to start is my colleague Carl Ernst's recent book called Following Muhammad. It's published by UNC Press. It's readily available here. And he does a really good job of talking about diversity in Muslim societies and how Islam responds to contemporary issues and what the fundamentals of the religion really are. But it's, I think, probably more important is to, well, nothing's more important than getting the basic education. And I think Carl Ernst's book, E-R-N-S-T, Following Muhammad, is a really good place to start. I also think that it's very important to disconnect religion from politics in the way Americans look at what's going on in the Middle East or in the Muslim world generally. When when things happen in the United States, we don't expect people abroad to say, oh, the Bush administration did that because they're Christian. But somehow, whenever a Middle Eastern government carries out a policy that we find confusing, we automatically claim that this is somehow related to religion, instead of looking for the reasons in local politics or international politics or domestic conflict or competition among ruling groups or race, class, gender, the same sorts of things that people use to analyze what happens in the United States, we tend to get kind of lazy about. And whenever something happens that we don't understand or don't agree with in the Middle East or in the rest of the Muslim majority countries, we say, this has to do with Islam. And it usually doesn't have to do with Islam. It has to do with any number of other kinds of issues. And it would be wonderful if people had a willingness to engage in those kinds of questions. So if this sort of thing were happening in the United States, would it be Christian? And if it's not considered religious here, then perhaps it has nothing to do with Islam and it has something to do with something else.
But it prompts me to ask, what relationship does Islam have to politics or within governments, various governments?
It varies a great deal. So that, for example, in Syria, you've got an explicitly secular government. The constitution is a secular constitution. In Jordan, Islam is the religion of the state and the monarchy, but it's a very secular society when you travel there. Turkey has an explicitly secular constitution, and right now there's some conflict because it's a religious party that actually has the majority in the government. And that's creating a conflict for some Turks who want it to, have always wanted to. So here's one of the things that, that is really fascinating to me. We have a secular regime in Turkey that insists that it's democratic. But when Muslims come, an explicitly Islamist party comes to power, the democratic secular supporters want to overthrow an Islamic government, even though that's not democratic. If it's a democratically elected government, even if it's Islamic, they want to overthrow it. We see the same thing happening in the Palestinian territories, where an explicitly Islamist government was elected in a democratic election, and the great democracies of the world have refused to recognize it and are trying to starve the population that voted for it. The human human conditions in Gaza right now are horrific. Yeah. The United Nations is warning that there'll be another explosion there. There's a tremendous amount of poverty and malnutrition, and it's a result of the United States and various European governments saying that this legitimately democratically elected government shouldn't be in power, and therefore we're going to starve the population until they're voted out. So saying that Islam is somehow incompatible with democracy, when also looking at the fact that it was an Islamic government that's been elected in Turkey, the Palestinian territories, It's America's great friend Mubarak who's keeping Islamic parties out of government politics in Egypt. It's really difficult when you look at the Middle East to figure out who it is that's against democracy, but it certainly appears to be the outsiders that are against democracy. Yeah. And
there's a long history of imperialism.
Supporting non-government. Yeah. I'm not sure that was a very coherently put, but what we're seeing is that indigenous forces are supporting democracy, and outside forces are trying not to. In Egypt, and in the Palestinian territories, the United States has taken a position against democratically elected governments in a variety of places.
Yes, I know it has. Actually, I'm repeatedly amazed at how this government in particular, but very many people, I think, in the U.S. seem to think democracy equates with capitalism. What they, you know, or with it's all right to have democracy in some other country as long as it's our democracy, the democracy we want you to have.
With the leaders that we like.
Yeah.
But we could turn your question around and say, so what is it about Christianity that keeps the Bush administration from not supporting democratically elected governments? And of course, it's an absurd question. It's not about Christianity. It's about a variety of international, political, economic, social reasons that the Bush administration is not supporting democratically elected governments, not only in the Middle East, but also in Latin America. Yes. And in a variety of places around the world. Now, if we use the same logic or lack of logic that we use to analyze the Middle East and say everything is about Islam, then we could say that Christianity appears to be inherently contradictory to democracy, because we have a Christian leader who is not supporting democracies. It's the logic doesn't work. It's not Islam or Christianity that are inherently opposed to or in favor of democracy. It's specific perceived needs.
There is, though, well, it seems to depend a great bit, a great deal on interpretations. I mean, certainly within Christianity, there are fundamentalist sects that are anti-democratic, you know, that won't, because whatever the Christian law in that interpretation has to supersede any kind of civil or secular law. And it seems also to be there's a great variety of interpretations about the relationship between the Islamic law, you know, and tell me a little bit, what exactly is Islamic law?
Islamic law was codified back in the medieval period. based on a number of different sources, but the general consensus is that Islamic law is to be based on the Quran, which Muslims believe to be God's revelation directly.
All right. It's
not
like
something
our
that,
Bible for many people.
Actually, the Quran is seen to be the embodiment of God's word. And so religious scholars, and this is something that I think you should bring Carl Ernst or one of my colleagues in religious studies in to talk about, but it's perceived as more like Jesus in it. It's the embodiment of God's word. Okay. It's not a book, it's the revelation. So that's the foundation of Islamic law. But Muslims also believe that Muhammad was not divine. He was not the Son of God. He's not anywhere similar to Jesus, but that he was an ideal human. And so much of Muslim law is based on what Muhammad did. So if you want to know how to behave and you feel like the Quran itself is the ultimate guide, but that you need more specifics, there's a whole science that has grown up analyzing what Muhammad did. So it's like the bracelets that say WWJD, what would
right.
Jesus do?
Uh-huh.
Muslims for centuries and centuries have had scholars analyzing what Muhammad did and what Muhammad said. And those things, the hadith or the reports of the prophet's life and work, are the other major source of Islamic law.
I see. Okay. That I had no idea about that. I knew that there were a great many interpretations, but I didn't know about the hadith.
So when we talk about Sharia law, what we're talking about is this combination of Quran and hadith and interpretations over the years. And for some reason, when the word Sharia is spoken by our particular anti-Muslim politicians and leaders in this country, they talk about it as though it's somehow an unacceptable form of religious law. But it's accepted, believed in various versions by millions, billions of people around the world. And it's really remarkable that it seems to carry, the word carries a stigma and, among people who would like to discredit Islam. It's simply Islamic law.
I think we are going to need to have another session so we can really try to understand a little more. I certainly would like to understand more, how it relates to political development in the Middle East.
I guess what I'd like to leave with is the recognition that there are many, many things that are fascinating about the Middle East and Muslim-majority civilizations in general, and that it's really important to look at those societies for what they are, okay. And that includes religion as part of the society. But the religion isn't the societies are not defined by religion in some way that's just automatically predictable.
Okay, all right, that's a very good point. Thank you, Professor Shields. I really appreciate your being here today. And I'm going to go get the Carl Ernst, and you have another book coming out, right? Or another, you have a manuscript now that you've completed.
That I'm trying to finish up and do edits on, and it's about the development of national identities in the Middle East in the 1930s. Uh-huh. And national identities and religious identities sometimes overlap, and they're sometimes very different. But there's tremendous diversity among Muslims. There was in the 1930s, there is now, and the Middle East also has many non-Muslims in it. Thank you.
Thank you. You are listening to WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. We're your local community radio station, and we are entirely listener-supported. Please visit our website at... I can't read it, actually, now. communityradio.com. Lucy, it's reflecting. I can't see the light. Can you just tell me what it is? Okay.
Communityradio.com?
Correct. Community, is that what it is?
COM.
communityradio.coop. Okay, I should have that here somewhere, but I don't see it. I thought it was posted, but in any case, please support and tune in again next week for